Welcome back to Refuge Radio. My name is Angie Horn. I am with the National Wildlife Refuge Association. I'm the SoCal Urban Refuge Partnership Specialist. And today I am sitting with Ian Shive, who is an LA-based photographer, author, and film producer, who's well known for documenting and capturing public lands around the world. He's worked with organizations like the Nature Conservancy and Sierra Club, as well as the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the National Park Service. Today we'll talk to Ian about the importance of conservation, connecting urban audiences to wild places, and his new film, Hidden Pacific, which brings the story of National Wildlife Refuge islands and marine national monuments to large format screens around the country. So Ian, thank you for joining Refuge Radio Podcast today.
Hi, glad to be here.
I know you're busy getting ready for another amazing trip.
That's true. I feel like I'm always getting ready for a trip though.
Yeah. So why don't we start with, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and the history of Tandem Stills in Motion and how you got involved in this work?
Sure. You know, I think like many people, I've always had a passion for the outdoors. And so for me, it was hiking and going into far remote areas of national parks and diving when I could. You know, living here in Southern California, you just have just a tremendous amount of opportunities to be outdoors and pretty much experience every sort of adventure you can imagine. So I've lived here almost 22 years now, and so it really just began out of having a passion for hiking and being outside. And then a lot of my adventures started taking me into places that people hadn't seen before or didn't know were part of the public land and water stories. One of the first big assignments I did was being embedded in a search and rescue crew on Mount McKinley, or Denali, using the proper term for today. It was McKinley then, but being embedded with a National Park Service search and rescue team. And a lot of people go to Denali National Park and they see the bears and the rivers and the great views and the mountains, and they may even see Denali itself if it comes out of the clouds long enough. But they don't recognize a lot of the other stories that take place there every day, including the search and rescue story. And so this light bulb sort of went off at that moment when I was part of that, that I realized that people were a big part of the story of landscapes and wildlife. And I'd really just spent all of my time and all of my career since then trying to tell those stories of how the two meet and their role in our lives together.
So what would you say your approach is to storytelling in the outdoors? How do you surface those stories? What do you look at what appeals to you first? Do you think about the audience? How do you approach storytelling in the outdoors?
That's a good question. The audience is always very important, but I think it begins with what strikes you first. I think like any good story, you have to be passionate about it. So you have to care about it. And so if it strikes you as being something that's interesting or that you care about, then more than likely, that's a good jumping off point for then seeing that other people will like it. That's always a tricky thing because you wonder sometimes, like, is my opinion just really only my opinion? and when you're in a format of media, whether that's photography or filmmaking, you rely on that other viewer to be successful, and to hope that what you find interesting and the story that you find compelling is that compelling and captivating to an audience. And so I think it has to kind of go through a process. I think it goes through a process of first identifying something you enjoy and then sharing that with a trusted group and an audience, slowly, and sort of working your way out until your audience is larger and larger and larger. And I think over time, after many years of doing it, you start to get a feel for what appeals to both yourself as well as what you think people will also enjoy. It gives you a lot more creative freedom at that point to then explore the stories and go on from there. But obviously, audience is the most important. Though I always joke around that my dream is to just take pictures that I never share with anybody, because that's why I started doing this in the first place, is because I enjoyed it for myself. That's the general idea anyway of how a story begins.
So how, speaking of storytelling, so you did a series of videos about the Urban Wildlife Refuge project.
That's right.
Years ago with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. How did that partnership come about? What interested you about documenting urban nature as opposed to these large remote landscapes that you've been documenting before?
Sure. Yeah, that's a great question. So I started with the national parks, working for the National Park Conservation Association and closely with the Park Service. And so I was already sort of a public lands photographer slash filmmaker. And in that years of working together and having some success, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service wanted to bring more attention to the refuges in general, because everyone knows what a national park is, more or less, but not as many people know what a national wildlife refuge is. And so they saw the benefit of having still images and videos that people could connect with, learn, become educated on, and then have a way to experience the refuges. And so they first contacted me many years ago already at this point, 7+ years ago. And it started like any relationship. It started small. We did a few photographs for the vision conference that they had as they started to rethink what the refuge system was here in America. And I did a few photographs, had a few of them published. And over the years, photographs developed into photo stories and essays and then video, which is something I've always been passionate about filmmaking. And I'd say it really rounded a corner with the Urban Refuge Program when we were looking for a way to connect urban audiences with refuges that were right essentially in their backyards. And I think a lot of people think, oh, you've got to go to have a wildlife experience, to have a grand nature experience, that you have to travel far or spend a lot of money. And a national, an urban refuge is not that. It's something that's there for everyone, and it's a lot closer than most people think. And as somebody who has lived his entire life in urban areas, was born and raised in New Jersey, and have lived here in Los Angeles for most of my adult life, I recognize the benefits of having those refuge areas close by from so many different perspectives, from just a mental health perspective, getting away from our urban lives and our phones and our emails and all the other traffic and all the other hectic things that come with it. But also, the recreation opportunities, the wildlife viewing, and obviously as a photographer, it's very appealing to have great photography opportunities nearby. And so as a urban resident, seeing that so many other people didn't even know that opportunity was there, was a no-brainer for me. It was an easy thing to say, okay, this is a grand opportunity to tell grand wildlife stories in urban areas, and people seeing it and realizing, wow, I had no idea this was in my backyard. It's one of the things I'm the most proud of, honestly, because we've produced a lot of urban films from San Diego, Philadelphia, Florida, New Orleans, Denver, Seattle and Portland, here in Los Angeles. A lot of time was spent in San Diego on a variety of small films that we did down there. You see people watching the films and reacting to the images saying, God, I had no idea this place was in my backyard. And especially youth, and you see younger generations having their first connection with nature. And just like me in New Jersey, where my first connection was in a local park, these people have a similar connection and will, I hope, over time, have a new appreciation for nature long term.
You've been in Los Angeles for 20+ years.
Yeah.
Have you noticed a change in the general public's relationship with urban nature?
I've noticed a change in the amount of traffic we have. That's for certain. It's certainly where our office is located. It's becoming more and more challenging just to get a couple blocks. But I have. Actually, our office is a great example because we have the Biona Creek and the LA River pathways and running ways right behind us here. And so, seeing that you can actually go kayaking in Los Angeles is pretty amazing. I think in general, what we're seeing in Los Angeles is actually what we're seeing everywhere in every city, which is this desire to have more access to the outdoors and to have access to wildlife and adventures, or just a place that's outdoors to spend time with family. So I definitely see that. I mean, over 20 years, I've seen a lot of different changes with LA too, and its environmental consciousness, if you want to call it that. I mean, the air is certainly a lot cleaner than it ever was when I moved here. I didn't even know mountains were there until a few years ago. And as smog started to break more often. There's just a multitude of things that I think are happening, but that's happening, I think, in most urban places, where we're in many cases struggling, I think, to find that balance of how do we grow economically? How do we grow as businesses and people who live urban lives and enjoy our, you know, 8-hour television binges? You know, how do we also balance that with completely escaping all of modern society and taking a step back into nature? So I think we're all looking at it. You know, I don't think there's a clear answer to it, but there's absolutely a change in the way we're thinking about it.
In the process of doing these videos with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, is there something that stands out to you as being surprising or memorable? Something you learned that you didn't know before in the process of doing this?
Yeah, I didn't know how many wildlife refuges were. I mean, that's, you think about it, it's like here's a person who spent a large part of their career photographing and filming public lands and didn't really know what a wildlife refuge was. I mean, it just had managed to escape that. And to me, that's such a tremendous opportunity to introduce people to the refuge system. I think there's, 567 refuges, something like that. I mean, that's an awful lot of refuges, you know, when you think about it. And so that was sort of the most basic surprise. But I think the thing that really surprised me was the breadth of the refuges themselves. You know, we discussed the urban ones where you can see a bison and the Denver skyline in the background and have places that are accessible to cities. But you also have the iconic wildlife moments that you expect to watch, you know, on some big television series somewhere where it's, you know, the sky blackened by birds and pods of orca swimming freely in coves in Alaska, or, you know, millions and millions of seabirds in Alaska Maritime National Wildlife Refuge, for instance, that as they're leaving the rocks, you know, 3 hours later, they're still leaving that same rock because there's just so many species there, grizzly bears and places like Kodiak Island and then the most far reaches of the Pacific, and going out to the coral atolls where there's some of the healthiest shark populations that are left in the Pacific, some of the healthiest corals in the Pacific, some of the greatest biomass and biodiversity in the Pacific. You know, those are also all national wildlife refuges. And so as my career and opportunities expanded with the Fish and Wildlife Service beyond urban and going into these substantially wilder places, you know, that really surprised me, I think, to recognize the true breadth of the refuge system. It's everything you can think of.
So you mentioned being active outdoors was always sort of part of your experience growing up and starting in parks and you know, things like that. Would you say there was a moment where you became a conservationist, or has that aspect of conserving nature always been a part of how you conceive of the outdoors, part of your experience in the outdoors?
It's a gradual process. I think it's a process that's still underway even today. I think it's because, you know, I tend to be an analytical person, and I don't think there's a lot of, I think most of the answers of what's right in conservation can be in very gray areas. And so I tend to be, you know, very open to looking at the whole story and the whole picture. So I can't say like there was this one moment, but I think like I said earlier with like that seed that grows from childhood, like I think the second the seed is planted, inevitably, I think everyone starts to feel some degree of responsibility. That they become conservationists. To what degree they become it, I think, is really up to the individual. You know, obviously, as somebody who's very embedded in the conservation world and is very passionate about it, you know, I'd say it grew larger with me than other people. But it doesn't need to go to that extent, I don't think, for everybody to be effective. I think it's little steps, big steps. I think they're all important steps, nonetheless. But I can't really pinpoint a single moment. To be honest, I don't know that I've really thought about it that hard. That's a good question for sure. It wasn't a single moment, but there's definitely been a series of absolutely incredible moments where you're like, oh yeah, I'm pretty lucky to see this kind of stuff. I mean, I think those moments, those that have a strong emotional resonance that you always think of when you think of your past great moments in the outdoors, are each of those are turning points in conservation.
You've seen more of our public lands, I think, than most Americans ever will.
That may be true.
So do you have a personal favorite or maybe a hidden gem that people don't, you know, people think of the big name parks and refuges. So what have you seen that you think, wow, more people should get out and see this?
I mean, I always am most excited about wherever I was last. That's kind of my issue. But yeah, I don't know. Hidden gems are tough. You know, I have been very lucky to go to a lot of places. You know, going to the national park, almost all the national parks, and many of the monuments and national monuments and lake shores and all those places. And now I forget how many refuges I've been to. Somewhere close to 50, probably. You know, it's hard to say. I think the best secret place I will never reveal, but no, I'm just kidding. I don't actually have one in mind, but I don't know. That's a tough one to answer, because they're sort of all the same but different, you know. I mean, it's like you can go, and like I've had great experiences in Rocky Mountain Arsenal and outside Denver, where you see some great wildlife and some of the best photos I've taken. I took right there outside Denver, you know, I'm in town, you know, 20 minutes later, where, you know, I've been spending a lot of time in Alaska lately. So that's fresh on my mind. And, you know, I always, growing up in New Jersey, I always dreamed I would go to a place like Alaska. I actually didn't even dream I would go to a place like Alaska, to be honest. I think it was only Hawaii. And then Alaska just seems so far removed, but to now spend as much time as I'm spending there is pretty wild. And so there's been just tons of experiences there. I thought Kodiak was an absolute gem. It was much more than I ever imagined it would be. The views and just what it looked like across the board was spectacular. I was also lucky enough to go to Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, which was pretty great. And that was also, a bit of a dream of mine to go and see that refuge and get to the interior, which I was able to do. So, but I mean, it's all pretty special.
Speaking of hidden, you have a new movie, Hidden Pacific.
That's true.
And I'll let you talk a little bit about that. How did it come about, and what made you want to bring that story to the big screen?
So it's not just me. I have Tandem, which is a company of very talented individuals that help create a lot of these projects. And so when I go into the field, especially if water's involved, like it is in the Pacific and the coral atolls, we have an underwater cinematographer that we bring. And we tend to approach every project as sort of like a land, air, sea approach. And one of the big turning points in my relationship with Fish and Wildlife Service was the 75th anniversary of the Battle of Midway. You know, Midway is both a national memorial as well as a national wildlife refuge. And so there's a very interesting and compelling story there of sacrifice in World War II with its evolution into this flagship of oceanic conservation. And that was a really interesting story to me. And the Fish and Wildlife Service and I were able to work together. They asked me to go out to help produce content to share the atoll, which, you know, few people have ever really been able to go to. And so we went out and we shot for whatever it was, a couple of weeks, a normal process for us, and came back and realized that we had just a tremendous amount of footage. I mean, and I had never expected that. I mean, the corals and pods of hundreds of dolphins, and the Laysan albatross, and seeing Wisdom, the oldest bird in the world, and her latest offspring getting banded. And we ended up having a ton of stories. And so, you know, we had set out to produce a 10-minute piece and ended up producing a 40-minute piece, which ended up becoming a longer form film after the fact. After we gave Fish and Wildlife everything, we were able to create another longer piece. And that's called Midway, Edge of Tomorrow, which is out there on all the digital platforms now. And then and that was sort of the foundation for what became the next project, Hidden Pacific, being the end product. But similarly, Fish and Wildlife Service said, well, you know, there's other atolls of the Pacific, and, you know, you went to Midway, which is part of Papahanaumokuakea Marine National Monument. We'd like to also see Rose Atoll Marine National Monument. We'd like to see Pacific Remote Islands Marine National Monument, in addition to Papahanaumokuakea. And those are the only three that are visitable of the five marine monuments. There's one in the Atlantic, Northeast Canyons and Seamounts, and then there's Mariana's Trench out in the Pacific, the deepest part of the ocean. So they asked, because the Fish and Wildlife Service recognized that there's it's the best way for people to visit. Photography and film is a form of visitorship in a place that is 1,000 miles from the closest inhabited island or more, and very difficult to get to, and then also ecologically very sensitive. This they recognized, which is tremendous in my mind, that they saw this opportunity and recognized the benefit of bringing it forward. So they asked me again to produce another short film on the marine monuments that could be shared through visitor centers and education platforms and still images for the Fish and Wildlife Service. And just like before, except now we'd spent three times as much time and all the islands, we had a ton of footage. And so we began the idea of saying, well, how can we reach people in a broader way? How can we go beyond just visitor centers? How could we go beyond all of that? And so we began the exploration of educational venues and theatrical releases versus a digital release. So we did digital with Midway, you know, it's like on Amazon and iTunes, but I was like, okay, well, that's one way to reach people, but now let's take Midway and let's take these other two places we went and combine them and reach a younger audience. And the best way was, I was thinking about my class trips as a kid and going to museums and aquariums and things like that. I mean, those were the best days, right? When you went to the Natural History Museum and you saw the dinosaurs, and then everybody puts on their 3D glasses and sees a movie for 40 minutes. That's ultimately what we identified as being the best opportunity. And so Hidden Pacific was born out of that. So we looked at all the footage. It took us almost another 2 years to reassemble 240 hours of footage. So we could have made Hidden Pacific 24 times. But we reassembled all of that footage into what essentially became a 40-minute giant screen IMAX theatrical release that will go to museums, aquariums, and I was just in New Orleans where it opened at the Entergy Theater at the Audubon Aquarium, and right off the French Quarter. And it's opening in Chicago and all these other cities throughout the summer, in Florida and New England and the West. And what's great is it, you know, going beyond like traditional television, you know, we were able to create an educational curriculum for it, 64-page curriculum on all the species that are in the film that kids and their teachers can tear a page out of and learn about before they go and then watch the movie. And now, you know, for the next year or up to 5 years, as long as the film is out in those venues, we're going to have just school group after school group and kids and their parents and everybody going in and experiencing a marine national monuments that, you know, up until, you know, we got back, you know, a year ago, people didn't even know what they were. You know, if you Google them, you won't find any photos. You'll find a handful of photos that are 20 years old. And so when people are talking about these places and they're part of the conservation conversation, how do you begin to even talk about them? How do you begin to understand them? Do you read a scientific literature that came out about it? Or do you sit down and watch a movie for 40 minutes and go, okay, yeah, I get what it is. And so that's ultimately the evolution and genesis of Hidden Pacific and where it is today. So it's certainly very exciting for me because it's my first movie. And I'm really proud of it because it's just beautiful. It's all the birds and things I'm talking about and schools of fish swarming around cameras and giant crabs that live in jungles that are, you know, the size of a volleyball and as well as the science and the work that Fish and Wildlife Service is doing out on the marine monuments. So, yeah, I'm excited. And by September, it should be in most cities. So we're excited.
What is the basic message that you want audiences to take away from Hidden Pacific? Because most people are not going to visit these places.
Right.
But, you know, you want to create that sense of connection so they become more engaged in nature in general.
Right.
So is that sort of the basic message? Are you trying to foster a sense of conservation awareness or?
Yeah, conservation awareness, absolutely. I think if I had to distill it to one word, I would say education. I want people to become educated on what their marine monuments are and what these places are. You know, like I was saying, like if you Google, you won't find anything on it. And so this is essentially a comprehensive giant screen format film that you can put on glasses and literally in a 3D immersive environment experience the place. And what better way to become educated on what it is? And then, and similar to how we started the conversation about like the seed idea and something growing, especially with youth groups that will see the film, you know, I see this as being their first, potentially many groups, their first connection with nature. Maybe an even greater chance it's their first connection with the ocean and the underwater worlds that are there. So I think there's a lot of things that are going to happen in it. But I think the real basis of the whole thing is all about education, letting people know what's there, why is it a national wildlife refuge? Why is it a marine national monument? And seeing the value of that by seeing the life that lives there and calls it home.
What's next for you, and what is your dream location? Where have you not been that you want to go and would like to capture on film?
I dream of maybe some time off, as I've been going from one project to the next for years. So that might be a pool and with a lounge chair alongside it and an umbrella in my drink and over me. But I think I'm working on a massive project in Alaska right now. And there's a component of it that's in 8 other parts of the country. And it's actually a very short window of time. It's about a 6-month production timeline versus the 2 years that we just had on Hidden Pacific to create what is essentially twice the amount of content. And so I can't say too much about it, but I am very excited about it because we're going to go similar to how we went to places that no one had ever really been before, filmed before, in the more tropical parts of the Pacific. We're going to be in the rougher, windier parts of Alaska, in islands and places that have don't even show up on some maps that we'll be seeing for the first time. So that's what I've been working on, keeping me busy these days, and I'm very excited about it. But as far as a dream location, I think after Alaska, I'll probably be looking to go back to warmer weather. I would really love to see the national parks and refuges of the Caribbean. Getting out to Puerto Rico would be really interesting, and Vieques. I think that'd be great. I never did make it to the National Park and the Virgin Islands, so I'd really love to see those and round those out. When we were doing Hidden Pacific and working with Fish and Wildlife Service, we had a stop that we made on Ofu, which is in American Samoa, and that's where the National Park of American Samoa is. And that was great because that's a very hard park to visit. I think it's technically the farthest park. I think it's the only park in the Southern Hemisphere too, if I'm correct. But it's way out there, but it's spectacular and worthwhile. Our group was the only group out there at the time. So you basically have an entire beach and some of the greatest fish and things I've ever seen. So I've always liked the ocean. So anywhere that there's just a vibrant ocean ecosystem that you can still experience, because there's less and less of them these days. That's generally what I seek.
Is there anything else you'd like the audience to know about you?
No. No. I think only that I'm just really grateful for the opportunities that I've had and the amount of trust I've been given to tell the stories of these places. Because every time you go to a place that no one has ever really been to or filmed, and you know they probably won't be going back anytime real soon either, that's a pretty big responsibility. I mean, you are representing it. You are how people will understand it. You are the lens, literally in this case, that they will see it and through. So it's a very important thing, and I approach every project in that way. With a lot of respect for the subject matter.
So where can people find you on social media?
They can stay in touch on Instagram at Ian Shive Photo. My name is IanShive. At Ian Shive Photo is a great place. I post URLs and photos and project updates, preparing to send some video clips as well and all kinds of little stuff. So it's a great place to not only stay in touch and see what I'm working on, but literally see what I'm working on. And then for the film Hidden Pacific, I'm posting updates on Instagram as well as on Hidden Pacific. com. That's the official URL of the film. And as it opens through theaters through summer up till fall, we'll be posting updates there as well as a trailer soon.
So thank you, Ian, for your time today. Thank you so, so much.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. It's fun. So we're looking forward to seeing Hidden Pacific that will be rolling out to theaters nationwide. And we'll be back with a new episode of Refuge Radio in a couple weeks. So thank you very much.
Thank you.